So our guest this morning is Michael Burberry, and what I'd like to do is, hey Michael, are you still on?
Yes, I'm here, Dennis.
Great, excellent, buddy. Listen, would you please give us an overview of the kind of things that you'd love to discuss on the call today, and then we'll pick our way through them.
Okay. Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone on the call. My name is Michael Burberry. Been a member of the Ormus Group for almost 5 years now. So long time on the group, and I've written books of notes of all the wonderful information you can get off the group as well as off the internet and many other places. I started off today putting together an itinerary of what I wanted to cover today, and the list I'm going to attempt to get through is first off starting with charging your Ormus, which was requested by Mel, of which I've got four categories of charging Ormus. One from I've written that Barry has put up on his site, which is wonderful, with a charger that's made very similar to the Orgone Holy Hand Grenade that you may find on the internet. With some minor adjustments to make it a little more efficient, but there's still a lot of work going on that one as well. Then I'd like to talk about static magnetic field, which is probably something quite new to a lot of people, but is pretty much the basis behind how the water trap works, but we'll get to that shortly. Then I'll talk about charging Ormus in a pyramid or pyramid structure. And then finally, using either an Orgo cage, a Faraday cage, or something equivalent to the Ark. Oh, and the fifth one, which I penned in, was using kyanite, or kyanite as some people pronounce it. I pronounce it kyanite. Blue kyanite is the one that I use. Okay.
Right, and so what else do you want to talk about besides charging Ormus?
Once we get past the charging Ormus, the second one on my list was actually the crystal shock method, requested by a person in the group. Hopefully they're on the call, but if not, they miss out. That's where we actually process quartz crystals and extract the Ormus from those crystals. Then I'm going to cover a distillation, which is what I call the backyard distillation. It's very simple. Anybody can do it, and all you need is stuff you already got in your kitchen. Then I'll be talking about processing the vegetable material, or what I just call the plant process, which is a fairly long process, but there's the good things that can come out of that. Then I was going to cover the H2O2 method with the adjustment that I've done, which makes it a little more successful. And just as a reminder for those that have just joined the call, if you press star 6, it will mute you, star 7 to unmute. Okay, moving on. I'd like to have a quick chat about what we call the Cleopatra bath, which to all information that we've been able to gather is actually what Cleopatra used to bath in. It wasn't milk at all. And then finally, if we can and we've got time, I'll move on to processing dew water to create the fly ash, as I discussed in the conference. If we get to that, that'll be great. I've also got three other items listed down, but it's unlikely we'll have enough time to get to them. But we've got to cover the universal fluid, the Tashmashi theory, some philosophy on the stone, microclusters and phase transitions, and also the fifth element of the alchemy.
Well, that should fill up the call, buddy. So, Michael, I'd like you to start with, just so everyone's up to speed on this, a little bit about your background and how you got to have the understandings and knowledge base that you do have, that you basically invent from. You use that as your foundation to invent from.
Okay, sure. My father was an electroplater. So I was involved in electroplating as my first job ever. I was a chrome plater, gold plater, you name it, we plated it. Don't know if many of you remember, but Cliff Young was a 75-year-old man who ran from Sydney to Melbourne, which is about 900 kilometres. And he ran that in his gumboots, and he came first, past all the Olympians. And the gumboots that came through, I was the one responsible for gold plating. And that became the trophy for the Sydney to Melbourne run. And it still is.
Outrageous. Gold gumboots.
Okay, moving on. I went and did industrial chemistry at the University of Western Sydney. So basically I'm a qualified industrial chemist. The industrial chemistry I concentrated on was predominantly with metallurgy and electroplating, and that was my major. I went back to uni after that and did mechanical engineering in marine technology because I was interested in boats and I used to race boats, so I went back and did that. And then after I did that and I worked in a marina for quite a while and I didn't particularly like it, I went back to the university and did electrical engineering in computer technology and design. So I'm also a programmer and I fix computers.
That's a very adequate description of a multitasking boffin.
Yes. So I can do across many, many fields, which is actually a good thing because it gives me a more wider understanding of how some things work.
Yeah, big time.
Okay.
And so you want to lead off with charging ormus, which is a fascinating subject that I've been exploring myself, and I want to hear what you know.
Okay. First off, I'm going to start by saying with ormus precipitate, and even after you've processed metal, the precipitate that you have, or the white powder that you have, in my view, is like a battery, okay? And that battery can store a charge. It's a very special charge. It's actually a very fine, subtle, and extremely powerful charge, but it is also very static. It doesn't move very much in the way of distance, but it moves very quickly in a very small distance. I'll get to that a bit later because I'll be able to explain that if we get to it. However, the charging of the ormus can give a lot of benefits. I found that some benefits can be absolutely wonderful from being able to make ormus that has some real kick to it, that you only need very small amounts, so instead of taking a whole teaspoonful, you end up only having a few grains to get the same result. It is extremely good for topical applications, particularly for me. I mean, I'm quite a fair-skinned sort of English background person that's come to Australia, and the Australian sun kind of hurts my skin quite a bit because I am fair skinned, so I do have some cancers that have formed on my skin. And using the Horizon salt and charging it up to a reasonable degree, mix that with some essential oil, and then stripping off the middle layer, I rub that onto my cancers and they disappear, which is absolutely wonderful. It's better than laser surgery. So they're the type of benefits you can gain from charging your ormus. You can end up using less to get the same result. That's the primary goal, I guess. To actually charge it, though, there are various methods. I'm going to start off with the one that that I put together that Barry's hosting on his website. So on the Subtle Energies website, under the directory ormus, I believe it is, there's a file or a HTML there, which we'll post up on the group later for everyone's reference. And it's just mb-ormus-charger. And I printed it out, and it's about 18 pages worth of reading. So yeah, there is a fair amount of material there, so I'm going to skim over it somewhat. So for those that want more detailed information, it's actually up there on Barry's site. We'll post it to the group a bit later. And, okay, we'll start. I'll just skip over these pages, which is not terribly important, and get straight to the actual device. The device itself is based off a holy hand grenade that was put up by the same people that also put up that other link of information saying white powdered gold is not so good for you, and then Barry's response to that saying, well, there's no evidence there. So, yeah, believe it or not, these people are actually making ormus. So I find it quite amusing that they say it's bad and then they teach you how to build a machine that makes it itself. Moving on. The things you'll need is some fiberglass resin, five double terminated quartz crystals. I found rose quartz to be quite good. The small ones are about $5, so five of them is about $25. Fiberglass resin's about $4. In fact, all up, once you've put the entire ingredients and everything you need together, you're probably looking around $50 to put together a device. You'll need copper wire, some hematite beads, some magnetite dust, a martini glass as the mould, though you could make a mould out of wood. Though wood's not so great. Plastic would be better. Something that you can wax or spray some non-stick cooking spray to, because once you pour the fiberglass resin in there, you want to be able to get the thing out of the mould. Okay? Okay, you wire up the crystals in a X with one sticking straight up. I hope that kind of makes sense. One sticking up from the middle of the X, the other four in an X-type pattern. You wire that just with normal copper wire so they just hold together nicely. All the copper wire should be wound so that when you're looking at the top of the crystal down the wire, it's actually turning clockwise. I hope that also makes sense. But again, it's up on Barry's site, so you can actually see the pictures as well. Once it's wired up, you then pour some fiberglass resin that you've pre-mixed into the mold, fit the crystals, the one pointing up, face down into the mold, so it's actually, when you take it out of the mold and turn it up, it will be facing up, but you face down into the mold, pour in some copper bits. I've used gold beads, copper ball bearings, several other copper or gold metal would be quite sufficient. Under that, it's also got a wound coil of copper, which again, if you're looking from the bottom of the glass up to the coil, it's actually turning clockwise. I found clockwise to work better than anti-clockwise. In fact, I did wind one anti-clockwise once, and it seemed to be quite detrimental. So clockwise seems to work, anti-clockwise doesn't for some reason.
Would that change depending on what part of the earth you were on?
Actually, no, because I've sent some to people that are in the other hemisphere, and they've had similar results. And for some reason, it wants to work clockwise, doesn't matter where you are. Okay? Into there, you pour your hematite beads. You then mix some more fiberglass resin up with the magnetite powder in the fiberglass resin, so the fiberglass resin is black with the magnetized powder. Pour the resin into the mold and allow to set. I know that's difficult to kind of explain on a conference call, and we'll put the link up for that on Barry's site later. But once it's set, take it out of the mold, turn it up. If you place your hand over it, you'll feel a cool breeze, but there is no breeze. That's one of the unusual things. I'm sure Dennis has felt that one as well. And I know Dr. Jen also wrote a message into the group saying that she was leaning over at a time, and she said the field was very strong, and she didn't stay there too long. For people that are quite sensitive to these types of energies, you probably want to keep it outside. However, for smaller ones and for people that are not so sensitive, including myself, I'm not all that sensitive to these types of energies. I'm actually quite resistant to it for some reason. I actually keep one under my bed and I sleep on it. I get charged up all night long.
That would explain the eccentricity.
Okay. How was that? That's a good start. How are we going on time?
That's good.
Okay. Moving on then. The second type of charging I'd like to talk about is called a static magnetic field. Whenever you have a cylindrical magnet, such as those used on speakers, the North Pole is on the top and the South Pole on the bottom, obviously depending on which way you hold it up, but basically the top or bottom is either north or south. Okay? When that is polarized in that manner and it is cylindrical, the magnetic flux will flow out of the north around to the south around the outside, but the center of that magnet is actually static. There is actually no flux flow through the center. It actually remains very static. Okay? That's actually something important
to remember.
Is this
a donut-shaped magnet?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, now my understanding is that with a donut-shaped magnet, you get a donut-shaped magnetic field with a central peak that comes up. And I'm not sure what, is that the static part?
The part that's static is the part that's actually in the dead center of that cylindrical magnet.
Okay.
The stream that comes up is actually coming off the top or the bottom, but not the center. The center actually remains static. It is a charge, but it's static. It doesn't move. The same thing is you've got a whole bunch of magnets and you, like, join them together in a ring. The same thing happens. Okay, the dead center of that, it's like a Lagrangian point. It remains very static and doesn't move much at all. And if I was to borrow a term from Michael Faraday and the Faraday cage, Michael Faraday built a Faraday cage which is designed to reflect EMF. It's used in the computer industry, particularly with housing large computers in data centers, but also it's used in smaller computers and even some laptops and even telephones these days. The Faraday cage is a box of metal with small holes in it. Okay? And basically Michael Faraday was saying that any magnetic field that moves, the magnetic flux that moves, will go around the cage, but any static magnetic field will penetrate through. Okay?
Okay.
Now, I wanted to highlight that because we'll be talking a bit about that a bit later as well. But the static magnetic field that's in the center of a donut-shaped magnet is actually a very good charging point. So if I was to get a bunch of donut-shaped magnets and stack them on top of each other so they're, you know, good 8, 10 centimeters tall, and then get a small bottle of Ormus and put it in the center of those donut-shaped magnets, it will charge. It will charge fairly slowly, but it will actually charge. And I've had examples where I've put it in that static field, taken it out, put my finger in it, and got zapped. So it will actually start charge inside that static field. But the other interesting thing that most of us may know about Ormus, is as soon as you put Ormus near any large magnetic field, it tries to get away. But when it's inside that static part, it's got nowhere to go. It just stays there, and it kind of gets compressed into the middle of the bottle as well. So when you take the bottle out, if you've got precipitate in there and it's wet, you take the bottle out, all the precipitate is sort of like gravitated to the center of the bottle with water around the outside. It's actually quite unusual.
That's wild.
Do you have any pictures?
Sorry?
Do you have any pictures of that?
I don't at the moment, but I can certainly get one.
That would be great.
Yeah, okay. And so how big are these magnets, Michael?
The ones I've got, they're about 7 centimeters in diameter, and the hole in the center is about 3.5 centimeters in diameter. And okay. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of them. They're all stacked on top of each other. And the magnetic field's actually quite strong. I can't separate them anymore.
Right. For the Australians, where did you get them?
Oh, okay. There's a place in Sydney that sells them that I posted on the Sydney group. There's another one in Melbourne that I also posted on the Sydney group. But there's plenty of international magnet suppliers, and these magnets were $1.50 each. And I needed 7. So that's an extremely cheap charger.
Great deal.
Okay.
Great. Fabulous.
All right.
Charging method number 3.
Yep. We're going to go straight now to the Pyramid. Pyramid is a wonderful device. I've got one behind me that I've dismantled at the moment, but it stands about 1.5 metres tall. It's made of copper tubing, joined together with large ball bearings and just super glued together. And whilst I've dismantled it at the moment, I can easily super glue it back together. When the pyramid is erected, its angle of inclination on one of those tubes is at 53 degrees, which matches that of Giza. It's also scaled to that of the Giza pyramid. And I have another wooden tripod, if you like, that I can hang a nylon fishing wire with any metal I like into the king's chamber area of that pyramid that's aligned one side to face magnetic north. It will slowly melt over many months. Okay, it's not an exceedingly efficient method, but the metal that melts, it will form an oil. You capture it into just a small shot glass, allow it to dry, you get a white powder. You put the white powder back in to the pyramid in that shot glass. As long as it's in there for short periods of time, when I say short periods of time, just a couple of days, it charges it up quite nicely. But if you leave it in there for an extended period of time, the gold white powder that I created will turn to a silver metal. Okay, so for some reason it deprotonates.
Any idea what silver metal it is?
No, I don't have a sufficient quantity for a spectrography.
Uh-huh.
You need a minimum of 150 grams. I have probably 5 grams.
Does it?
It's a slow way to grow metal.
Any way to tell from the color or?
It's actually just like silver, a dull silver.
Okay.
It's still quite soft, but yeah, it just looks like a dull silver. From what I understand of the way the pyramid actually functions, is it is a very slow process of deprotonation. So protons from the atom get ejected out through some form of unusual radiation that is beyond my means to be able to measure. But yes, if you take your precipitates or white powder or even your trap water and put it in the king's chamber area of a reasonable-sized copper tube pyramid, it will charge over a period of about 1 or 2 days. Any longer than that, it seems to dissipate very quickly. So you don't want to have it in there for too long. And it's quite experimental as well, so the amount of time will probably vary depending on where you are and how your pyramid's built and how well it's made and so on. So that one is still quite very experimental, to say the least. Okay?
Yeah, sounds pretty fascinating.
All right, moving on then.
How big is your pyramid in terms of size, Michael?
It stands 1.5 metres. Its base is about, close to 6 feet. You know, it's almost 2 metres on the base square. So it's a reasonable size. The copper tubing is your standard half-inch copper tubing that you get for housing water pipe. And the large ball bearings I purchased from a bearing shop, and they're about 1 inch in diameter, simply to super glue the tube to.
Right.
And those ball bearings are chrome steel, stainless steel. So that one is quite large. I have seen smaller ones. I attempted to put together a smaller one myself, but the bigger one was more fun.
Right then.
Okay.
Next. So you want to head into method number 4.
Method number 4. Okay. Here is the unusual part about the Faraday cage. As I was stating before, the Faraday cage allows the reflection of EMF away from, generally computing equipment inside the cage, But it is basically a steel box with small holes drilled in strategic places. But it does allow the passage of a static magnetic field. Now, if I am reflecting back all the EMF, the static magnetic field of Earth and all the planets around us and everything that generate these fields are going to be inside that cage, but no EMF is going to be inside that cage. So that cage also acts, even though very inefficiently, it does actually act as a charger. And if you put your trap water or precipitates in there, it will very slowly charge. And whilst I'm just giving it as an example, the Faraday cage, you can actually purchase them. They're not terribly expensive, but they're generally made out of steel and they're quite heavy and not terribly efficient, but you're looking at probably a few hundred dollars for one. So moving on from that, I wanted to talk about the orgone cage. It's a slightly different design to the Faraday cage, but again is designed specifically to reflect EMF but allow static magnetic field to pass through and accumulate inside the box. Now, in this case, the orgone cage by Wilhelm Reich was a layer of... The first layer needs to be a non-conducting material. Now, a non-conducting material like plastic or wood. The second layer needs to be a wire mesh, generally steel wool is what he used. Then it needed a semi-conducting layer, and in this case he used wool. And then he would then put another non-conducting layer and go through multiple layers of that box. Now, in those days, anyone that sat inside these cages, as a way of saying it, they would undergo healing, as he put it, and in some cases, some people even had a healing crisis inside that box, and they had to limit the amount of time people spent inside the box down to 2 minutes, because any more than 2 minutes, the people's body would be coming charged inside the box. They didn't quite understand what it was that they were doing. And these static fields would accumulate inside this box, and he called it orgone. So if you're wondering what this orgone energy actually is, it's an accumulation of a static magnetic field, which is also, moving on, exactly what the Ark of the Covenant was designed to do. The Ark of the Covenant was, as we know, acacia wood, surrounded by gold on both sides, acted like a big capacitor, but also in the center or in the middle of this particular box, it was an accumulator of static magnetic fields. So basically, the mana that they had inside the Ark was being charged whilst it was in the Ark, and given the design of the Ark and the shape and that it resonates with very specific frequencies, it charged it up quite a lot, to the point that people were zapped by the Ark. So if you're wondering why it was actually doing it, the reason it was doing it is because the mana was the battery inside the Ark. The Ark was the accumulator of the static magnetic field. The mana would then be charged. The Ark, being covered in gold, which is a nice conductor, would conduct that. Anyone that touched it would ground it. In fact, I believe they only had to get near it, and it was enough that it would ground through them. And they used to tie ropes to the priest's legs when they went into the room to the Ark, because if the Ark zapped them, they pulled them out with the rope because they were too scared to go in near it. So it was
they hadn't figured out having insulation on their feet by then.
No, they hadn't.
So, well, they could have just done seen the guys in with Nikes.
Yes. So the goal behind charging is basically to apply a static magnetic field to the actual the material that you wish to accumulate the charge into. And some great material, such as the white powder of gold or salt precipitate, but even trap water, will accumulate a charge. And given one of my larger charges at one point. I had a fairly large glass container of water. Turning around, I'm looking at it. It's about 15 litres, so that's, what, about 3 gallons for those in the Imperial still. I sat that on one of my largest chargers and basically left it, and I kind of fairly much forgot about it to actually go and check it. And I came in one day, and it threw a 2-metre-long arc to my garage door. So...
that's a serious arc.
Yes. I mean, it looked like a Tesla coil.
Yeah.
It was angry. So, suffice to say, it took me quite a while to actually remove that from my garage. I first removed the actual charger. It's now outside. Because, yeah, it was a bit oversized. Stick with small ones, people, if you're going to build one. Don't build a big one. These can be powerful things. And the water itself didn't discharge. Every time I got close enough to actually discharging it, it would self-recharge and do it again.
So keep away your children and pets.
So it took me about 3 months to get this... 3 gallons of water out of my garage, and it ended up on my front lawn, and then I ended up having to mow my front lawn weekly. So that's the first 4 charges. Moving on to my last one, which is the most unusual one. There was a gentleman on the group. His name was Margie9. Well, that's what his handle was on the group. I haven't seen him on the group for quite a long time, which is a shame, because he had a friend that did muscle testing. What do you call it again, Dennis? Do you remember?
Kinesiology.
Thank you. And he wrote to me one day as a personal message, not on the group, just to my personal email, and said that I should go out and buy some blue kaonite. And of course, I didn't think much about it, but thought, yeah, why not? I'm going down the crystal shop anyway because I'm buying some more rose quartz for my quartz method, which I'll get to a bit later. So I went down to the shop, and just as I got there, a courier was pulling up, and it was her delivery for new crystals for the month. And I walked in as the courier was walking in. I asked her, I need some blue kaonite, and she said, that's what the courier's delivering. So I got the pick of the kaonite there. The package was literally arrived as I arrived. And I pulled out a nice large piece, which she gave me for $30. I mean, it was an arbitrary amount for the size. The piece I got is about 1 foot long. It's a good 5 centimetres thick by 7 centimetres wide. It is a very deep, navy blue kaonite that's kind of shelved, which is hard to explain. It's like layered, as if it'd been like grown over a millennia in different layers. But each layer had sort of joined together. So it kind of looked a bit like wood. I mean, when you chop through a tree and you see the rings of the tree, it was like that, but in layers. Large piece, actually very large piece. And the lady said, oh, if you're going to charge up your kaonite, leave it out in the sun. So it was a nice hot day. In fact, it's a nice hot day today. It's 36 degrees already. I'll just turn the fan a bit closer. put it out in the sun on a nice hot day, and then brought it in, and I was going to do a wet method with salt like I normally do, and I thought I'll put the kaonite underneath. And I put in my sodium hydroxide, and the precipitate all rose to the top. It didn't sink to the bottom. So I thought that was particularly unusual. Took the kaonite out from underneath the container and put it on top, and all the precipitate went straight to the bottom, which was wonderful, which is what I was after. So I just sort of left it there, not thinking too much about it. Came back the next day, and I noticed the precipitate was sparkling. It was like giving off small flashes of light.
Wow.
Yeah, which was particularly unusual. So I took the conite off and thought, oh, I'll charge it up again. I'll go put it out in the sun. So I took it outside and put it outside in the sun again. And I came back in, and I'm talking probably 2 minutes later, and the precipitate had gone. It vanished. Completely vanished. And I was looking at my big log ball glass, thinking, where's my precipitate gone? I was making that. So that was particularly strange. So I thought, okay, I'll tip it out, and I'll start again. So started again, put in more salt water, dropped in the sodium hydroxide, got the nice cloudy look, went outside, got my conite, put it on top. All the precipitate went down to the bottom within about 20 minutes. So it just sort of like flew away from it. And it didn't sparkle so much, so I thought, right, I'll just leave it. Come back the next day. It was slightly sparkling. So I took the conite off, but this time I was smart. I didn't want to leave it and take it away and go outside. I just put it down, like, next to the container and drained out the water, took the precipitate out, and washed it straight away. And I noticed with this particular precipitate, as soon as any magnetic field went near it, it would run away very quickly, like zoom across through the water.
I thought, translate, run away again?
Sorry?
Translate what you mean by run away?
Run away, okay. It's in a large glass container. This glass container is that I've used for my washing is about 15 centimetres across and about a foot and a half tall, cylindrical container. I put my precipitate in there, and I actually do my washing in there.
Yep.
As soon as I put any magnet near it, the precipitate, which has dropped to the bottom, will literally zoom through the water across to the other side of the container.
And you don't have any way to do a video on your digital camera?
Not my cheap one, no.
And you don't have a good digital
snap-off
camera?
Shot.
Pardon?
I can still snap off some shots, which will give an idea.
Good.
Okay.
It's really
important
to document this stuff. It really is. I mean, these are amazing, amazing stories.
Well, this is why you're recording the call.
Well, yeah. But that's not nearly as good as recording the
visuals. Yeah.
Suffice to say, Barry, I'm not terribly interested in creating another 3 gallons of water in my garage that throws 2-meter-long arcs just so I can get a photo for you.
That's why it's important to document it the first time.
I was more interested in getting it out of the garage.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So anyway, moving on, I found that the blue conite is actually, when you charge it up in the sun, does impart a charge on the ormus, but it does not appear to be a static magnetic field. In fact, there's nothing magnetic about it. It's just particularly unusual, and it does actually charge it up. And even when I finished doing the precipitate was a lot lighter than normal. So it did take a long time to settle, and even when it did settle, it still wanted to float up to the top and sink down the bottom and float up to the top and sink down. It took days to actually settle.
Now, was this the precipitate, the very first precipitate from your Horizon Salt, or was it the washed precipitate, the pH swing precipitate?
No, this is after a first swing, and I'm doing the first wash.
I see.
Okay?
Okay. Did you notice any of these effects before the first swing?
To a lesser degree, yes.
Okay. Was all of the precipitate involved, or was there a separation with the precipitate?
No, it was all.
Okay.
No separation. It actually all decided that it wanted to be away.
Good info.
Okay.
And just so you can fill in the missing piece here, Michael, how did you do that swing?
Oh, okay. When I finished washing, doing the first precipitate, okay, and the precipitate sinks to the bottom. I take the kyanite off, okay, drain the water out. I then redissolve it in vinegar, just standard white wine vinegar, and then top it up with water again and then precipitate it a second time. Then I take that water out. Then I transport the precipitate into the bigger container for washing.
Okay.
Okay?
So you just did lye and then white vinegar and then lye again.
Correct.
Yeah. Cool. Excellent. Say that. Thank you.
Okay. After that first lesson, playing with it with the magma, which was entertaining to say the least, I then drained that water out, took the precipitate out, and put it in one of my usual brown bottle dropper bottles that I keep, and put it in my cupboard. Which is generally where most of my precipitate goes. It goes into my big metal cupboard that I've got here. And I come back and I play with it again later. I don't generally consume it. Most of the precipitate I make, I have a very special process I make for one that I actually consume on a regular basis. But most of the experiments I do, the result generally ends up in my cupboard that I play with at a later time.
You label it?
Most, no.
I've got a whole cupboard of stuff that I don't label. Oh, I wish I'd labeled it. Oh, I wish I'd labeled it. I've got years ago that I didn't label. Oh.
Well, the thing is, I know what it is because of where it is in the cupboard.
Uh-huh.
I can't tell you exact dates of when I've done it, but I know what one is what.
Yep.
So if I was to go to my cupboard, and it's locked, it's got a key, you know, keep the kids out, I can go to that cupboard, I can open it, I can take something out, and I can tell you what it is. And the things in my cupboard are arranged.
You could probably put a label on it, couldn't you?
Yes, I could. One day, I'll get round to actually labeling it all.
And then take a picture of all of these bottles of stuff in your cupboard. Oh, that would be so wonderful.
Sure. And it just looks like a bunch of little dropper bottles. But anyway. Yeah.
Given all that, just a brief question here that's kind of like tangential to what you've been saying. You did make a remark that you don't consume this stuff, but you do have a special process for what you do consume. So why don't you briefly talk about that?
Shortly.
Okay.
Okay. I wanted to get back to actually finishing the story with the kyanite, which is why the kyanite lives outside now.
Okay, yeah.
After I finished washing it and I put it in that little bottle, I put it in the cupboard. It was quite late at night, so I picked up the kyanite and put that into my cupboard as well. Big mistake. Came back the next day. Most of the precipitate that was in various bottles had decided they wanted to leave the bottle.
No.
Yes.
Carry on. What happened?
Were the bottles sealed?
Yes.
And
the seals were not broken.
And how could you tell that it had left?
Because most of the bottles were empty.
Uh-huh.
The bottom of my cupboard was covered in white powder, and the kyanite was up the top.
Oh, wow.
Then unusual things started to happen, such as the white powder decided to move on its own. I took the kyanite, put it back outside in the sun, and so it could charge up again so I could play with it some more. Came back in, and most of the white powder that was in my cupboard was now spread across my garage floor.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So, particularly unusual things came out of that kyanite, which then got even better. A couple of days later, I went out to get the kyanite to play with it, and the kyanite was gone. It appeared again about 3 months later on my windowsill.
Twilight Zone.
Yeah. But that kyanite has now found its home in the garden. It sort of lives there now. and I don't play with it that much at all anymore because it was just something that was too unusual to explain. However, I'm not going to say that crystals do not charge ormus because I believe they do. If you put crystals out in the sun, they do actually gain a charge of some description, and that charge can be imparted on ormus. But in most cases I've seen, the ormus wants to get away from it. So if you're going to be playing with charged, sun-charged crystals and ormus, make sure your ormus is in a good-sized container, and that the crystal's on top, which kind of pushes the ormus to the bottom. But it does charge it generally overnight, and if you take the crystal away, hopefully your ormus will stay. Okay?
That's amazing.
Yes, the kyanite and other crystals I've worked with have been unusual, to say the least, and behaves strangely with ormus.
That's amazing. Like, I've got a couple of my ormus-making containers that have got some kyanite crystals taped around the outside, but they're only relatively small amounts. They weren't a big chunk of a slab like you described, and I haven't noticed anything particularly unusual happening like you just described. So,
you started in the sun?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, that's
okay. I'll do that.
Yeah, if you're working with a crystal and you want to use it as a charger, it needs to have a charge to start with, and then it gets that charge from the sun.
Okay.
The sun imparts a charge on crystals.
Okay, most useful. Thank you.
All right?
Yeah.
So, next time, Dennis, stick it out in the sun, come back to your ormus. If it all disappears, don't blame me. Or
right,
it ends up over your kitchen floor or wherever you do it. And talking about crystals. Okay, I think that's enough on charging. We've already been almost an hour just on charging.
Why don't we take a couple of questions on the whole subject of charging before we move on to the crystal,
crystal
technique.
Process.
Yeah.
Questions first from the free room. Anybody in the free room, unmute yourself by hitting star 7. Any questions in the free room?
We'll take that as a no. How about the benefactors room? Hit star 7 and speak up.
I have a question. Hello?
Yep,
you're on.
By charging ormus in the charger, when you then consume it, is it that much more potent?
Yes. At the beginning I was saying the most beneficial thing about charging ormus is that you will need less. So instead of a teaspoon, which is what I generally have each day, you would need, well, in some cases, less than 1/8 of a teaspoon to get the same result.
Now, I noticed some similarities between your description of the arc from your bottle and the charged water that Danae Harding creates. Would you say that your process is similar in some way?
I've had a look at Danae's process from the wonderful video that Barry provided, and I noticed that she actually imparts a charge using a Tesla coil, so you, like, zaps it. Would that create a static magnetic field? It's possible. So there would be some similarities. However, she uses a lot of energy to impart a small amount of energy on the actual water. Doesn't seem overly efficient to me. The magnets, if you put a bottle of water inside cylindrical magnets and impart the charge on that, it'd take a couple of days. You haven't used any electricity and you get the same result.
Thank you.
Okay, nothing against Diana's method. I think she's doing a wonderful job, but it's just not entirely efficient. That's all.
Okay, but the mechanism is the same, would you say, or similar?
I'd say in concept, possibly similar, yes.
So you're talking about the same kind of energy, static, electrical,
yes.
Electromagnetic?
Static magnetic field, yes.
Okay.
But in the case that Diana's doing, he's using a Tesla coil, which generates extremely high voltage at extremely low amperage, okay,
mm-hmm.
Which is like lightning. Lightning is extremely high voltage but extremely low amperage. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
When you're passing that much energy or pressure through any medium, it will generate a static field.
Now, you also mentioned, I don't know whether you were being facetious, that you had to mow your grass once a week.
Yes.
And so there was a very localized acceleration of growth?
Yeah, when I put the charged water, you know, I was getting it out of the garage in, like, very small spoonfuls at a time and growing it on the lawn. And my lawn was growing at about 4 to 5 inches a week.
Okay, and what you observed was localized accelerations of growth?
Yes, the back lawn didn't grow like that.
Okay, but clearly wherever you applied discharge water, there was an acceleration?
Yes.
Did the water consumption of the grass or the water requirement of the grass change?
No, Barry, I was attempting to slow it down. I threw salt on the front lawn.
Uh-huh.
I tried to slow it down. I got tired of mowing it all the time. I don't water the front lawn. It was just growing on its own.
Wow.
And it doesn't rain too often in Sydney.
Yeah.
In fact, we're still pretty much having a drought. And it rains here in Sydney probably once a month, if that. And even then, it's not a lot of rain. The front lawn, it didn't get any water.
Okay, Barry, your theory, though, is that when ARMUS is applied to soil, it's the increased benefit to the mycorrhizal fungi that will accelerate the growth of a plant that's exposed to that. Would you suggest that that's what's going on here?
I would suggest that it may be holding the water, storing whatever water falls. The biological substances in the ground will hold more water. The more fungi and more bacteria that are there, the more water they'll hold, and the more minerals that they'll put into the plant. So if they're energized in some way, the underground fungi and the underground bacteria, if they're energized in some way, they'll bring more minerals into the plants, and of course that will make the lawn grow better and provide more water. Or let's say hold what water there is.
I'd agree, Barry, and I'd like to also comment that the water itself, if you get it on your skin, feels a bit oily, but it, like, seeps right into your skin straight away.
Oh, yeah.
So, have you noticed any longer-term effects from doing that, such as, I don't know, healthier skin?
Oh, for me, definitely. I mean, I have another process that I described earlier in the call that I use precipitates and an essential oil and shake it up, and then when it separates into the three layers, the center layer is generally an emerald green, and you take that layer and rub it on your skin and your cancers just drop off, which is great for me. I mean, I've got quite a few. I'm a fair-skinned person, and, mm-hmm. and Australian sun has caused quite a few cancers to appear on my skin. Which my doctor tells me I've got to get lasered off, but I just put this on there and they quite literally fall off.
What type of essential oil do you use?
Sorry, I have two people.
What type of essential oil do you use?
Oh, generally the cheapest. the one I quite like is organic olive oil, which is yellow. However, I've got, what's the one up here that I've been using lately? Sorry, this one is sandalwood.
Sandalwood, okay.
Yeah.
Because different essential oils have different healing properties, according to people.
Yeah, I've been
practice.
Trialing different ones, see which ones work better and which ones don't.
Uh-huh.
The sandalwood's actually quite good. The mere oil didn't work too well. It kind of really dried my skin up very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I had a rose oil as well. That was extremely good. My skin went really soft. but it wasn't getting rid of the cancers, which is my main goal. The sandalwood actually does work quite well. But then again, so does the very cheap natural organic olive oil. That works quite well as well.
Have you noticed that you get fewer cancers since you've been ingesting Ormus? I've noticed that my skin doesn't get burned. It's very hard for me to get a sunburn. Very difficult. My tan doesn't seem to go away despite the fact that I never get in the sun. Have you noticed any effects like that?
I still get sunburn, but then again, Australian sun is kind of strong. I'm going to say that up front. It's now, my temperature gauge saying it's now 37 degrees at the moment, so it's also very strong today. Mm. We also
warming
get
up.
Time all the time. And the answer to your question, Barry, is I don't get new ones, but the old ones are going.
Okay, that's very good.
And for the American folks, 37 degrees is around about 94 degrees Fahrenheit or something.
Thank you. I was going to ask.
Michael, this is Peter. And the way you made your garage charger, was that with magnets?
No. That one was the charger that Barry's hosting on his website, made with the crystals, the magnetite, the copper, etc., in a much larger scale.
Okay.
Hey, before we take any more questions, I'm going to announce the raffle winners. The first one is named Bryce.
Not of West Australia. Yeah.
The second one, Crystal.
Crystal is a lucky girl. She's won twice already. Woohoo. Good on you, Crystal.
And the... Is it two or three?
It's two.
Two? Okay.
I have one more question for Michael.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that your precipitate, when you put it in one of your cupboards, it increased in volume.
Ah, yes.
And
yes,
it would be great if you could talk to that.
Yes, I have a glass here. That's why turn over. Okay, this glass is about 18 centimetres tall. It's about 5 centimetres round cylindrical glass. It's covered in alfoil, your normal cooking alfoil. Has alfoil over the top held down by a rubber band. Okay, inside was actually some silver Ormus that I did with the hydrochloric acid and hydrogen peroxide method, through which I've made a fairly minor adjustment to that process, but for me it works a lot better, and I was hoping to cover that today if we get time. I put the white powder of the silver in this glass, covered it up and put it in my cupboard, and I was actually going to come back to it later. Well, I completely forgot about it. In my usual thing, I get sidetracked with all different things that I do. And I came back to it about a year later. In fact, I think it was probably close to a year and a half later. And I opened the glass, and lo and behold, I look into the glass, and the glass is full. Now, this particular powder, it doesn't, fall from the bottom up. It's like growing inwards from the sides. So it's like attached to the side of the inside of the glass and is growing inwards.
Wow.
And I took half
more, more Twilight Zone music.
Yeah. I'll grab a photo of that later too. I took half of it out and actually did some experimentation on it, trying to determine if it was protovoltaic by compressing it between two metal plates and attempting to measure any voltage, and eventually threw it away because it didn't. But put that glass back in the cupboard, left it there probably another 6 to 8 months, came back to it later, and it was full again. Again, growing from the sides towards the centre. I'm just trying to find it. Yeah, there it is. Sorry, I'm just picking up. I'm looking into it at the moment. It's about a third full at the moment. It's still growing in from the sides. Down the bottom has about 1.5 centimetres thick. And from the sides, it's about... one side's about 1 centimetre thick. The other side's probably closer to about 5 to 7 mil thick. And it's still growing towards the inside.
Wow.
And what is it that you think this is?
That's a good question. Like I said, I only put silver ormus in there to start with, and about a teaspoon of it. I mean, it wasn't a great deal because processing sterling silver is, you know, kind of expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to skip that there so I can get a photo of it later and put it up on the groups.
Good.
And what do I think it is? I do think it is actually ormus, but what type of ormus, like what particular mineral, I have no idea. I mean, it would be too difficult for me to determine because of how difficult it is to actually do any types of assays on dried powder ormus, particularly after my last episode of trying to get an assay, which ended up breaking their assay machine, but anyway.
But is there any liquid in this?
No.
Okay.
It's dry.
Okay.
That is
and, yeah, it's growing in from the side of the glass, kind of like clouds growing inwards towards the center.
And this container is completely surrounded by aluminum foil?
Yes. I thought it was a reasonable storage method to store my silver ormus at the time. I didn't expect the unexpected.
But it does.
No.
And hopefully, say, when I describe my H2O2 method and the slight adjustment I've done, which is probably more alchemical adjustment than anything, I'll describe how I actually made that silver.
One question about that. You mentioned that you've made 24 different white powders from 24 different metal elements. Is that
yes.
true?
Yes.
With the peroxide method.
Yes.
But you also said that you've made additional elements, converted additional elements into white powder using another method or
right.
other methods.
Yes.
What other elements and what other methods are there?
Okay. There are no less than, given my list at the moment, 22 methods that I know.
Uh-huh.
Okay. For all the usual transition metals, such as the list which I actually printed out today, so I can go through them, it's titanium, vanadium, rhodium, iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, turn the page, niobium, molybdenum, which wasn't molybdenum, I've got to do that one again. That one I was actually processing coins, which I found out is just copper and nickel.
Yeah.
Anyway, ruthenium, rhodium, it's palladium, silver, tin, so on. Anyway, I won't list them all out. They're up there on the group anyway, if anyone wants to read it. All those transition metals, some are dissolvable by hydrochloric acid, some are not. For the ones that were, I started with a metal oxide, which actually worked out easier to break down. However, the important thing here is what the other ones were. There are metals which are alkaline. You put them in hydrochloric acid and they'll just fizzle to nothing. Okay?
Right.
So if I was to take cesium, which is an alkaline metal, it's element number 55 on the periodic table.
Right.
Okay? If I put that in hydrochloric acid, it will just fizzle away very quickly. Okay? The hydrochloric will react with it extremely quickly, which is no good for this particular process. Okay? For the cesium metal, the best way to process it is to actually burn it with potassium. Okay, now, I'm an industrial chemist. I got the right equipment. I know how to work with these types of metals. I wouldn't recommend it as a kitchen alchemy. This is lab alchemy.
Right.
Okay, but yes, I have also converted cesium, looking at my list here, barium, and strontium. Actually, strontium's a good one because you get strontium in apples. So when you actually do a plant process, which I was hoping to get through today, if you do it with apples, the primary mineral in there is strontium, which is now by metal. It's actually quite good. And the ormus turns out quite nicely.
Now, how can you tell that it's ormus?
It dissolves in ethanol, but will not dissolve in hydrochloric acid or nitric acid.
I see. Now, what makes you think that ormus, all of these elements will dissolve in ethanol? Is that true?
Yes.
There's some question about whether that's supported by alchemical literature. Are you familiar with any alchemical literature that suggests that might be the case?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch the meaning of the question.
Are you familiar with any alchemical literature that suggests that ethanol or alcohol will dissolve the white powder?
Yes, that's about all of them. That's what mercury is.
Okay, you think that is the alchemical mercury?
Correct. Actually, not correct.
Okay.
All right, let me read this from an alchemical practical guide in alchemy.
Uh-huh.
It states, mercury is the transcendent spirit or neshama of something. In practical alchemy, it is a gaseous substance, which is another way of saying that it is a liquid substance with a low boiling point.
I see.
Okay. In plant alchemy and in most other alchemy, the mercury will be a liquid solvent and is most commonly known as ethanol.
Wow. What's that a quote from?
Sorry? I'll put the URL for that later. This was the Herbal Alchemy on a Budget by Alex Summer.
Okay.
I'll post that link up later. It's actually very good. Very good.
Good. And any other element that you've used the potassium burn method on?
My notes just quickly. Strontium, cesium, barium, selenium. Selenium. That's about it.
So that's 28 elements total.
Okay, yes.
Do you think that this might be something that all metal elements are capable of bringing to a white powder?
Yes. I can safely say yes. Maybe some of the ones up the top of the scale, which can only be man-made and have very short lives, I don't think so.
Probably not, yeah.
Most of the others, I'd say yes. Also, the ones that are laphanides or actinides, neodymium being a laphanide, okay, that one I know you can, but some other laphanides, such as, what's another one, europium. Okay, europium is a particularly unusual metal. It's extremely hard to get on your hands on, and it's generally radioactive. So whilst I haven't touched it, thankfully, I probably won't. Do I think it will convert to a white powder? I'd say possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
But even then, I probably wouldn't want it.
Right.
Okay?
Very good.
Any more questions before I move on? Okay, so far we've covered charging and a few questions, and we're already halfway through the call. And I had 10 items on my list, and we've covered one. So I'm going to talk a bit faster. No, I'm not. I'm going to talk now about the crystal shock method. It's one of my favorites, actually. One of the ones I like doing with Milky Quartz when I head out inland. There's a lot of gold mines that are in Australia that are abandoned. Australia, particularly New South Wales and Victoria, during the 1800s had a gold rush period where there were people out digging gold left, right and centre all over Australia, and most of these mines are still around and they're abandoned and they're probably hazardous. But more important thing to remember about these mines is when these people are looking for gold, the first thing they look for is milky quartz, because the gold grows where the milky quartz is. So what makes the milky quartz milky? I think we know the answer. It is a liquid inside the quartz. They are very small liquid bubbles. They are milky looking, okay? So if you pick up milky quartz, inside your quartz is gold ormus. So, we're going to extract it. This is the crystal shock method that I've talked about to a few people, and I did one time post it to the Sydney ormus list, but never made it to the main one, and I never got round to really documenting it right, and I do intend on doing that with photos, because the process itself can be done in the backyard or could be done in the kitchen, preferably in the backyard, because when you listen to how the process is done, you'll understand why. Okay, the actual process itself, you'll need about half a kilo of quartz crystal, preferably milky crystal, rose quartz crystal, amethyst, whatever you can get your hands on, and in small pieces. That's the important thing. And if you're going out and buying crystals from a shop, if you ask for small pieces, they'll be happy because they can't sell small pieces, they only sell big ones. So they'll give you a kilo of small pieces of some crystal that you decide upon at generally a very cheap price. So you can get it quite readily and quite cheaply. You will need about half a kilo, which is a pound, and you will need two stainless steel pots, one particularly large one. I would say one capable of holding 2 gallons, or for the people in Australia, it's about 6 litres, 6-7 litres, you know, it's a reasonable size pot. You'll also need another saucepan type pot. The one that I use is about 12 centimetres across, okay, diameter. The wall's about 7 centimetres tall. And it's, you know, used for making sauces. Anyway,
say the diameter again.
Sorry, looking at it, it's about 12 centimetres across, 7
okay.
centimetres tall, standard saucepan for making gravy.
Right.
Okay, they are stainless steel. I got good ones as well, but don't have rivets on the inside. The handle is, like, welded on. That's also a good thing. Don't get the riveted ones. The rivets are generally aluminium, and I wouldn't even recommend cooking with them. So if you got the ones with rivets that are aluminium, don't cook with them. Throw them away. Get good ones. Okay, if you use these pots, don't expect to use them again for cooking. Because the process actually does eat away a little at the stainless steel, so the pots aren't going to last terribly long either. Okay, the actual process. You take the small one, you dump your half a kilo of crystals in it, you put it on a gas stove, and you turn your gas stove up, flat out. You want that pot to practically glow. Okay, the goal is to heat the quartz up to about 800 degrees. Your gas stove will do 3,000 quite easily, okay? I found the hotter, the better. So if you can get it up to 1,000, that's great. The crystals will start to glow, okay? But don't melt the crystals, okay? You're going to need at least 6,000 to do that, so you're probably not going to do it on your stove. Okay, moving on. When you have your extremely hot crystals on your stove, you take your other one that's about 7 litres, you fill it up with distilled water or natural spring water or water that you would generally drink, okay, not your tap water which has got fluorides in it and which will convert the fluorine when you pour the crystals in too, so don't use tap water with fluoride in it. Good spring water, natural distilled water or mineral water if you're hard up. Okay? You then take your red-hot crystals, whilst they are red-hot, and you dump them into that water. Those red-hot crystals, when they hit the cold water, will shatter. Okay, when they shatter, they release whatever minerals are in those crystals into the water. That's the important part. That's the part we're collecting. So you then need another one.
Suggest some safety precautions when you pour
your crystals. Oh, yeah, definitely. Thick jeans. You know, boots, steel caps if you got them, because if any of those crystals fall out and end up on your foot, they're going to burn your foot. Okay, these things are hot.
Uh-huh.
So treat them as they are really hot. You know, lean your hand out. You know, I'm actually doing this while I'm on a phone call, okay? Now, lean your hand right out over the top and your body away from that pot that you pour those red-hot crystals into.
Uh-huh.
And for those that are familiar with car glass, you know, you come out on a cold morning, you turn your heater on the glass shatters, okay? That's what we're doing to the crystals. We are shattering the crystals. They are breaking up. They will splinter. They will also become very sharp. So don't try not to handle them with your hand because it's sharp like glass. They also really hard. Sorry.
And probably some goggles?
Yes. So that's probably not so necessary because, you know, if you hold it out in front of you and you are the smaller pot only about 2 or 3 centimeters above the cold water and you pour it in, they're not going to go very far. And as long as you take care and do it like that, you'll be fine. But, yes, for those that are very conscious, yeah, definitely wear glasses. Okay? They do shatter. They come apart. They don't fly out.
Well,
okay.
I'm concerned about possibility of some of the hot water splashing.
The water's cold.
The water will be cold, but as soon as it hits that crystal, you may get something coming off that would...
Yeah, it probably wouldn't heat up that fast, but yes, I would have to agree. I generally don't, however, you know, up to most people, I would say... If you're doing it for the first time, definitely try and do it, okay? Because the first time, you don't know what to expect, and when you pour the crystals in, you hear them all crack and crumble and come apart, okay?
Yeah.
If you jump or move or do something that you're not expecting, you could drop crystals on your hand or they could come out or whatever,
right.
Okay? So, yeah, definitely I'm going to advocate take as much safety as you feel is necessary, okay? Particularly the first time. Okay, when you dump those the red-hot crystals into the cold water, they do shatter, they come apart, they release their minerals into the water. You then filter that water into another container, take the crystals out, put them back into the first pot, and you do the whole process again. Pick the crystals up, pour them into the water, filter the water, take the crystals out, and so on. After you've done it about 6 times, the crystals that are left are like a white sand. That's what they look like. And it doesn't matter what crystal you start with. You can start with purple amethyst. After you've done it the 6th time, the crystal will be a white sand. That's what it will look like. Okay? The water is now a purplish color. Because you have extracted the iron, which happens to be an amethyst, is now in the water. Okay? Once you've got the minerals in that water and you've taken away the quartz that is now in your fine white sand looking stuff, and you've filtered that off, and you take your water, and what I generally do with that water is I try and evaporate it down a bit, because 7 liters of water without a great deal of minerals in it is kind of difficult to process initially when you start adding lye to it. So if you can evaporate it down a little, so you're down to about half that amount, it makes it a lot easier. So that step is optional. Okay, you can take that 7 liters or 2 gallons of water, stick it in, it's already in a stainless steel pot, and start adding your lye to precipitate out the minerals. And it will work, but the precipitate will be a very small layer around the bottom. Okay? It's a lot easier if you evaporate it down, put it into a nice tall glass, and then precipitate it that way. It's easier to wash afterwards, that's all. So the step of evaporating it down is optional. Okay? That's it. You then take some lye, because the water is actually quite neutral, raise the pH up to about 10.5, which is plenty. I generally don't go much more than about 10.3, don't really need to, and the precipitate will, drop out, it will go smoky and it will drop out. If you use your milky quartz, the precipitate down your bottom is your gold ormus. If you use amethyst, it's an iron ormus. If you use citrine, it's also an iron ormus. If you use rose quartz, it's actually a copper ormus. Hint. And,
How do you know that?
Because it will dissolve what's in the quartz or that it's Ormus.
Which element is which Ormus from which source?
Oh, from which quartz?
Uh-huh.
Oh, there's a website that actually has done assays on all the different types of crystals and tells you the types of minerals that are in those crystals.
I see. Okay, so you presume that if it's on the website as copper or iron, that it will be a copper ormus or an iron ormus,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, okay, let's take a good example. Okay, rose quartz, which is copper. Okay, it's actually copper and iron. Okay, the only difference between rose quartz and ruby, which is also quartz, okay, they're both quartz. The only difference between the two is one is iron and copper, the other one is titanium.
Ah.
That's what gives it the color.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, I mean, it is actually quite easy to make your own ruby because you take your normal quartz, you melt it down, you add in almost titanium, mix it up, let it crystallize, and it will be ruby red.
Wow.
And you can grow your... In fact, that's actually one of the production methods for making man-made rubies is they take colloidal titanium and mix it in with the quartz and grow the crystal.
I see. So is the Ormus titanium white?
Yes, grayish white, yes.
But when it's mixed with the quartz,
red.
It becomes red. Okay.
It's got to do with the way it crystallizes and bonds with the silicon dioxide. Okay. So just for all the ladies that are online as well who I'm sure love wearing jewelry, the only difference between rose quartz and ruby is titanium. One's titanium, the other one's copper and iron. Anyway. So, once you have that precipitate, just wash it. It's fairly much ready. It's as simple as that. It's no more difficult that you just literally crack open the quartz, collect what you've cracked open from the quartz. You do it about 6-7 times to really break up that quartz, turns into white sand. Then you treat it just like you do with a salt water wet method. You can even do pH swings if you wish. Any questions before I move on?
Michael, I have one question.
Yes, sir.
Do you treat them?
Ruby is a corundum,
yes.
And is extremely hard. I think it's 9 on the Mohs scale.
Yes.
Quartz is not anywhere near 9 on that scale, so is it the titanium that's making the difference?
Yes. Yes, it is. Also, I believe also with ruby, it's got some carbon in there as well, which also helps.
Okay, thank you.
A quick question also. You can have rutilated quartz, both in the clear and the milky, and the you can have titanium needles in the quartz. Can you use that?
Yeah, but then I'd add an extra process to the end. When you get your precipitate, because those titanium needles in there are going to be the titanium metal, okay, not an ormus, okay, the... Once you get your precipitate down at the end, I would re-dissolve the precipitate in a strong alcohol, either an ethanol or a surgical spirit, which is diethyl alcohol, diethyl ethanol, whatever, or a good grain alcohol. Okay, you can get them fairly readily from most pharmacists, chemist drug stores, liquor stores sell the grain alcohol. Okay. What dissolves in the grain alcohol you keep, what doesn't, you throw away. Okay, once you've got the separation, the grain alcohol will float on the water. Okay, mix it up, it will float on the... You suck it off with a syringe, or you can use any other form of separation. You just allow that to evaporate, you'll get your powder.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
That just keeps the metal away from the ormus. It's a good way of separating metal from ormus. Because metal will not dissolve in an alcohol.
Michael, I have a question about the process in terms of the waters that you get off after each time. Are you doing the swing on each of those?
Optional.
Optional, okay.
Yes.
But you basically could get it from it.
But it does actually get stronger if you do.
So if we boiled it seven times, if we added the crystal seven times, we might do a seven different precipitations.
You could, yes. It'd take a lot longer, but yes. And going back to my original discussion on charging as well, I wanted to talk about the TH swing. It's an interesting subject. You talk to a chemist and they say you aren't doing anything. However, we know that we are doing something. One thing I've noticed is that when you dissolve a ormus or a precipitate or a mineral hydride into an alcohol, the particles separate. They become down to what I will call microcluster sizes. A microcluster is 10 or between 10 and 1,000 atoms. Okay? When you get down to that microcluster size, the microclusters will self-arrange into platonic solids of various types. And then when you start adding the lye to precipitate the minerals out of either an alcohol or water or whatever you're precipitating from, those microclusters have to undergo a phase transition. That's a transition from being its self-arranged platonic solid into growing into the bulk. That is actually a phase transition. During that phase transition, unusual properties exist. And if you go and look at any of the nanotechnology going out there, okay, they all describe that when they get to certain magic numbers of microclusters, and then they perform the phase transition to build up a bulk, they see unusual behavior, such as things they call super atoms, and they have also identified superconductive material during that phase transition. So doing pH swings is also a slight method of charging as well. There is something unusual that happens between the microcluster and the bulk. When it does that phase transition, there is unusual properties that happen in there that are measured with all the new nanotechnology that's going on around now. But if I look at it from an alchemist's point of view, that's a coherbation process. So it's something the alchemist kind of knew about and said that's when something is born. Okay? So they believe their material is born at that point.
Cool.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, sorry if I went a bit too far on that explanation of the question.
Oh, no, that's great.
That's the crystal shock method. Any other questions before I move on? How are we going on time? Okay, good. Okay. No more questions? Okay. Next one I'd like to talk about is I'm going to talk about a plant process. Okay, you can process any plant material. One of my favorites is mint, mainly because I got lots of it out in the backyard and I put ormus on it and it went nuts and now I go out there and pick it on a regular basis just to keep it under control. So, yeah, one of my favorites is mint. Okay, if I take mint, the very first process I need to do is to allow it to ferment. So I just stick it in a big jar that's got a sealed lid. It's actually one of those pickling jars that has the clip-down lid. I literally just dump all the mint in there, pack it down so it's nice and tightly packed in there, clip down the lid, stick it aside in my cupboard for generally about 8 weeks. Okay? In that time, the mint will start to ferment and there will be a nice little bit of water down the bottom of the jar. And that brings us to the second part. The second part, we need to distill it. Now, most people will go out and say, okay, if I want to do a distillation, let's say it's going to cost me $300 for a condenser, it's going to cost me $200 for Erlenmeyer flasks, and then all the other lab equipment you start talking about. And before you know it, it becomes rather unaffordable. However, there is an affordable method. The affordable method is a method that anyone can do, and it uses stuff that you've already got in your kitchen. Okay, what you'll need is a large baking dish. I know this is going to sound weird, but it actually does work. A large baking dish with high walls. The higher the better. The one I've got, turning over, is probably about 6 centimetres. The walls are actually about 6 centimetres high. So it's actually quite a high wall baking dish. Okay? You will also need a small cup where you're going to collect the liquid that you distill. And the cup, the height of the cup needs to be less than the wall of the baking dish. So the cup I've got, it's kind of been cut down mainly by me. I just got out a glass cutter and cut it down. And its walls are about 5 centimetres tall. And it's probably about 5 centimetres in diameter. Nice circular little cup. If you were to go and buy something, you know, like a Petri dish or something, actually probably the cheapest thing to buy is an ashtray. That sounds funny, but an ashtray would be perfect. Okay? Because it's round and it's got, you know, walls that are less than the size of your baking dish. Okay, you get your fermented mint or plant material of whatever you got, okay, and you take the baking dish and you spread the mint all around the baking dish, and then you create an area in the middle that your cup can sit in. So there's no actual material inside the cup. The material's all around the outside of the cup in the baking dish. You then cover the baking dish with cling wrap. In this country, we call it glad wrap, but that cooking wrap you wrap up your sandwiches with, that sticky plastic, you then coat it over the top, so you make it nice and airtight on the inside of that baking dish with a glad wrap, and then you get a stone or a weight of some sort, and you put it over the centre of your cup, so the glad wrap actually tilts down towards the cup. You then put it outside in the sun, and the sun does the work for you. As the sun heats up the mint, fermented mint that's inside there, the water will evaporate from that mint, hits the glad wrap, then follows gravity down towards the centre where you put your stone, and then drips into your cup. And that's how you do a backyard distillation. Nice and simple.
Awesome.
The stuff that you collect in your cup is known as the mercury. It is the solvent. Okay?
Yeah.
All with me? Good. I'll keep going. The second part of the plant process, you need to, once you've collected that water, stick it aside, put it in a nice, something sealable, you know, like a bottle that you put a cork in or something that you can seal it and keep it for later, because you'll use that bit later. The second part of the process, we actually take what's left of the plant material that's still in that baking dish. You cover it again with the glad wrap. You put the stone in the middle, put your cup back in the middle, and this time you put it in the oven. Okay? This time, instead of using the sun to gently distill it, we're going to use the oven to do a stronger distillation. Now, you don't want to take your temperature up to more than about 80 or 90 degrees because you don't want to melt the plastic cling wrap that's over the top. You don't want to melt that, so you want to... It's kind of a bit of an art form here. I mean, particularly for those that have done cooking, you need to adjust the temperature so it's hot enough that it's actually doing the job, but not hot enough that it's actually melting the plastic. Yes, I know. It's an art. It really is an art. I found between 80 or 90 degrees, so it can vary with ovens. So, you know, I guess you've got to play with that until you get it right. Okay? Which you're doing the distillation for? Believe it or not, that is the alchemist sulfur. Okay? It is called the fire of the plant. Okay, so the first part was called the air, the second part is called the fire. Okay, so you then take that, you'll get a small amount, you won't get a lot, you do get a small amount. Put it aside, it contains an oil, it actually feels oily, and it is fairly much the essential oil of the plant material. Okay, Yeah. There are other ways to extract it. This is just a natural way and an easy way. Okay, moving on. What's left in that baking dish is now kind of crispy and brown. So you want to take that, put it into a saucepan pot, similar to the one I described for the crystal process, for heating up the crystals, and you stick that in the pot, you take it outside, put it on your gas barbecue, and roast it to ashes. And I mean really roast it to ashes. And you don't collect the smoke, let the smoke go. And you just want the ashes that's left. So you really roast it to a white ash. Each time you roast it, it will, then, you know, initially it will go black, then it will start going grey. You need to actually, like, break it up with something. I got a pestle and mortar, and I just use the pestle to break it up. However, you know, use anything to break it up. Each time you break it up, put it back on the fire and actually really roast it as much as you can until it is snow white. And the ashes will go snow white. Once it is snow white, you're now ready for the fermentation. This is the fun part.
Say that again.
Oh, once you've got the white ashes? Oh. Okay, the white ashes is predominantly potassium carbonate, but inside that potassium carbonate are the minerals that were in the plant.
Okay.
In the case of bits,
what do you call that process?
Oh, that particular roasting it to ashes is called calcination.
Okay.
Okay. And if I scroll back up, mint contains copper. There you go. Okay. Once you've got those ashes, those ashes will be a potassium carbonate with copper and other minerals that the mint has. Okay. You take those ashes, you put it into a lady's silk stocking, preferably one that the lady has finished with, because you won't be giving it back to her. You then take the mercury and the sulfur that you created earlier, which was the first distillation you did in the sun, the second distillation you put separately in the oven. You mix those two together, mix them up nice and well, and then pour them over the ashes that are inside that stocking, so the actual liquid drains through that potassium carbonate, through the stocking, and into something you collected in. In my case, it happens to just be a baking dish, a glass baking dish. Okay? You pour that water over, then you take the water again, you pour it over, take it again, pour it over, do it about a good 20 times, and make sure you soak up as much of those minerals out of that potassium carbonate as you can. The eventual liquid will be smoky looking, and the pH of it will be quite high. It will be around the 9.5 or 10 range, okay? In which case, you just do one swing, which is you add a white wine vinegar, top it up with water, add your sodium hydroxide, let the precipitate drop out, take away all the water, which is basically salt, and you're left with your precipitate from your mint down the bottom. That is predominantly the minerals of the mint in an enormous form. Did I cover that too quickly?
Well, actually not quickly enough because we're out of time.
Oh, really?
I kid you not. We've just zoomed through 2 hours.
I had 10 items on my list. I'm only up to number 4.
That's great.
Okay.
We'll be able to have you do this again.
Yeah.
And again.
Okay. Like I said, Dennis, I said we'll see how we go. We didn't go too great.
This is excellent. This is really excellent. I'm really glad that you didn't get everything covered.
Too much? I hope it wasn't too much for some people.
It was way too much for... I mean, but we'll be able to listen to it again and again and again. So, this is great.
I'll post links up on the main forum as well. But there is one thing I'd like to say before we move on to anything else, such as whatever happens at the end of the call. I wanted to talk about frequency. Okay, in this case, hertz. as in number of cycles per second.
Yeah.
Okay. There's an important thing here that I want to discuss because I think people should know about this. If I have a frequency, in which case the Earth's frequency used to be 7 hertz, I think it's around 12 now. They use it for submarine communications underwater. Okay, cycles per second, it's quite good. That's a magnetic frequency. Okay, then we get up the range a bit further and we get to our frequencies that we can hear. So they're audible frequencies. Further up the range, we're back in the magnetic range and you've got your radio stations, different dials on your radio station. You can tune into individual radio stations just by tuning your tuner to a specific frequency and you can hear that radio station. Moving up the scale again, okay, we start getting towards light. So nothing's changed so far. All we've changed is the number of cycles per second, but it's still that magnetic energy going back and forth. But when that magnetic energy gets to a fast enough frequency, it becomes physical light. Okay, move up the scale, and we start getting the microwaves a bit further, and we start getting to alpha, beta, and gamma particles. This is where we have a phase transition. This is where the wave is no longer a wave because the wave is also spiraling. Okay, I know this is probably a bit hard to fathom for some people, but I'm getting somewhere with this. Now that the number of electromagnetic waves are now spiraling and moving back and forth very quickly, and you get up to that stage of the alpha particles, beta particles, gamma particles, they now have a fixed speed limit. The fixed speed limit being the speed of light, which was also the same speed as the speed of light, sounds a bit slower because it propagates slower. Okay? Going above that frequency, we then start getting to electrons. Electrons also inhibited by the speed of light. Going up a bit further, we get to hydrogen. Go up all the way through all the elements of the periodic table till we get to the very top. At the very top of the table, what do we have? We have ununium or something crazy that they name like that. When you get to that top, we're talking now in the exahertz range. That's 10 with 28 zeros after it times per second. Okay? Now, when we start going above that, when we start getting to around the 200 exahertz, that's 200 with 28 zeros after it times per second, that is now the recordable light force energy. And nothing has changed. Nothing has changed from when I talked about sound through electromagnetic, through the radio station, through light, through all the matter. All that's changed is the number of cycles per second, but we've now had another phase transition. Not only is it now spiraling, it's now spiraling in both directions at the same time. It is also no longer limited by the speed of light. Okay? So moving up through the light force range, we then get to an area of quite literally a number with more than 50 zeros after it. And that becomes the consciousness range. That's the range where thought operates. That's the range where thought in your brain actually operates. It's an enormous number times per second. Okay? Now, your thought is now so fine, not only spiraling in both directions, but going out and in to every place in the universe simultaneously. It is no longer limited by distance at all. And the only difference between myself and Dennis is that I run on one channel and Dennis runs on a different channel, just like you tune your radio. Okay, now that I've said that, up in that top range where the energy is extremely fine and extremely powerful, it can only work with the next range down. Just like matter can only work with light with matter, okay, matter doesn't work so well with electromagnetic waves.
There's no way.
Electromagnetic waves work quite well with electrons, but not with matter directly, but it can work quite well with light and electromagnetic waves. So up at the thought pattern, the thought range can work with the next one down, which is the light force range, And the life force range works with the next one down, which is matter. So the most important thing that I'm trying to describe out of this is that Ormus, and the Ormus that we're collecting, the energy range that we're talking about is in that life force range. Hence why it's important that not only does matter affect that range, but your thoughts also affect that range. Your thoughts can't affect matter directly, and the matter can't affect your thoughts directly, but that one in the middle, that's the one that we're looking for. That's the enormous area that we're looking for, and both your thoughts and the matter will affect that range. So I wanted to finish off with that as something to think about as a philosophical thought, and I'll now hand over to Dennis to carry on with, I don't know, questions, whatever happens at the end of the call.
And listen, what I'd like to do is say I'd love to explore that aspect of those range of frequencies leading right up to consciousness and so on again on our next call. And I don't know what your timing is going to be like, Michael, but I'm thinking maybe this time next month. Is that going to work for you?
I'll have to let you know, Dennis, because unfortunately, dread up this call, I'm actually going to work. Because I do work on weekends as well, so
okay.
It would depend on my work.
A to be announced.
Say that again, Dennis.
Let's make it a to be announced, to be arranged.
Okay.
Yes, I'll work it with you with my work schedule, Dennis, and we'll pick a date that can fit both of us.
Right, now we're so out of time here. So listen, unmute yourselves and say goodbye. Unmute yourselves and celebrate the call and just say goodbye and we're wrapping it up until part two at some undisclosed date.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's a tour de force of alchemy. Quite a phenomenal piece of interview and I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
So much, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Great.
I hope
thanks,
you make
Gary.
It.
Well,
fascinating.
Thanks, Dennis.
Michael, can you come to the convention?
How many were on the call, Barry?
30.
That's
great.
Not bad.
Plus about 13 on the free room.
Did the free room just drop out like when I was in the middle of something, or...?
Something like that, yeah.
That's a shame for them.
Yeah, too bad.
Yep.
So sad. That's why I encourage them to make a little donation.
Probably will now.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I email you with a question about the distilling?
Sure.
I didn't catch everything, and I actually have an 80-gallon distiller here.
Oh, lovely.
And so I didn't catch a few things, and maybe
more
I can just email
professional equipment.
What's that?
More professional equipment rather than just the kitchen waste.
Yeah, we make essential oil, so.
Oh, excellent. That's the sulfur. That's the sulfur
that's
part
the sulfur.
I was talking about.
Okay. So that's the fire, and then the air might be something else.
Here, so
correct.
Good night, good morning, and good day.
Bye.
Anyway, Michael, this is Peter.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. When you get some time, Michael, would you send your notes or your list of topics, and we can post them to the Ormus Forum, and maybe any pictures or any things like that, and I can put them up on my website.
Okay, thanks, Barry.
You bet, thank you.
Michael, can you just quit your job and work for Ormus full time?
So when are you going to come to the States and give a little talk for us?
Yeah.
Oh, well. I'm going to get there.
September 5th, 6th, and 7th.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, Michael, it's Ormus.
Okay, we're getting too much noise here. We just need to shut down.
All right. put up messages on the forum, everyone. Put your questions up there. I'll do my best to answer them.
Well done, Mike.
Thanks, everyone.
Well done.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael, for talking about charging, and I really appreciate you answering that question so thoroughly.